Hello and welcome to Real Geeks. I am Crash and Burn, and with me as always is Mike Montgomery.
Hey.
And today, it is the first week of coverage of Pride, even though technically it's not Pride here until next month in Halifax, Nova Scotia. It's complicated. Essentially, all summer is really super gay here, which is, yeah, no different than pretty much any other month. But it means that in this particular episode and the next three following, we're going to be covering some queer cinema of our choosing. Okay, mostly of my choosing and that one that I'm being forced to do. Forced to do, but I get my revenge in the end. Yes! Today, however, is a double bill of just plastic fantastic. It is 1988's Hairspray and 2007's musical film version, both technically by John Waters. Ta-da! Gay.
Well, it technically, I think it's more one is by John Waters, one is inspired by John Waters.
Exactly, and we'll get into that. There's like levels of involvement people can be when it comes to adaptation, and the level of involvement and the outcome of this is really fantastic and fascinating. And we'll get to that certainly.
Hey girl, what you doing over there?
Can't you see? I'm spraying my hair.
Let me tell you about the latest craze. Mama's hoping that it's just a phase, but I know it's gonna last forever. You gotta see the way it keeps my head together. I gave my dollar to the drugstore man. I bought that magic potion in a 12-ounce can. Now I know, but when I make the scene, they're gonna stop and wonder who's that beauty queen now. Oh, mama told me not to do it.
But first, we're talking about 1988's Hairspray, starring Ricky Lake, Ruth Brown, Divine, Debbie Harry, Sonny Bono, Jerry Stiller, Pia Zadora, Rick Ossek. I mean, like, holy crap, what a random collection of players, which is just pure John Waters. And this film is both his most sedate and approachable for the norms, and also semi-biographical, though at no point was he a girl on a afternoon dance doo-wop show. It's semi-biographical to like Baltimore in the early 60s.
Yeah, because like when you said semi-biographical, I was just sitting here going, how?
Yeah, it's like if someone growing up in Long Island but wasn't a mobster made a mobster. It's Martin Scorsese. This is the equivalent of like Goodfellas. At no point was Martin Scorsese involved in any of that, but it's very telling of like what the world he was like, he grew up in.
Okay. Fair enough. That works.
Yeah.
And also just one thing that I would say right off the bat, this is actually my first John Waters movie.
Ah! Oh, and good! It's only going to get more filthy from here!
Well, yeah, I was just gonna say, because if this is you're gonna be your first John Waters movie, that might actually mess with how you perceive the film. Because you're going to be expecting things that this film is just not capable of.
Yeah, no, this is easily a film that you can show to preteens with explanations of some context and language. There is nothing necessarily in this that appears constantly in other John Waters films that would be like, oh, sweet Lord, I forgot that's in this. Cover your eyes and shut your ears and just drink heavily to forget, child. Drink heavily. Because holy crap, sometimes his films go places, and they go places that are delicious for PG-18 audiences. Maybe 16. 16 if you're cool, you know.
Yeah, no, like, I'm familiar with John Waters enough by, like, reputation that was more what I expected. And I think I kind of had trouble connecting with this version of the film because of that.
Mm.
But there would still be that odd moment where I'm going, oh, there it is. There we go.
Yeah, like tiny little things. Like, for instance, John Waters appearing as a white supremacist conversionist with a hypnotized gun. And it's just, yes, that is proper stupid. Stupid. And very much like one of the few moments in this film that reach realistically. I mean, I know that those kinds of assholes exist, but that was a cartoon character. He was playing a cartoon character. Whereas pretty much every other character in this, even the ones played by Divine, aren't cartoonish. They're over the top, but like,
well,
there's a difference.
True, but I think I would say though, Leslie Ann Powers, her Penny Pinkleton, was so just batshit insane.
I would suggest that she's actually a more restrained, or less refined and less focused version that we get in the 2007 film from Amanda Bynes.
Yeah.
And so, like, now I came at this film the other way. I watched the musical first years ago and then saw this film. And so to me, the character is better done by Amanda Bynes. And so the scattershotness and the uncommitted nature of this character as performed in the 1988 version, relative, it's not that it's bad, it's relative to the 2007 version. It for me, it just doesn't connect as well.
I think I did misread IMDb. I had the wrong Pinkleton.
Aha.
I was trying to refer to her mother, Joanne Havrilla. Where in the musical, yeah, Allison Janney was an overprotective religious zealot mother with Joanne Havrilla. Like, she was entertaining as hell, but it's in that I have no idea what is happening right now, but it's hilarious sense.
Yeah, whereas it's... again, far more like concentrated and figured out for the musical, because you have a finite amount of space and room in a musical, even compared to a film, for character development and like bits. And so where they were kind of allowed to go a little hairy with her in the original, they pared that shit down.
Oh, they very much did, and it almost becomes more believable because of that.
Yeah, it's certainly more realistic in the sense of, like, it's not... I guess there are three levels of cartooniness. There's barely dramatic, semi-realistic. There's over the goddamn top, literally John Waters, the director, has entered his own film. And then there's middle ground where it's like the madness is creeping in, but we're not there yet. And this is definitely a film that is the madness is creeping in, but we're not there yet.
Yeah.
This, like, I love it. I recognize it as the classic it is, but it's very much in the same vein as, like, it's a Swing Kids. It's a But I'm a Cheerleader. Like, these are films that find preteens who are a little awkward and they hold on to it for years and eventually they move on. And it's like, it's influential, but it's not really the best film. You know, it's just, well, that was what was available and what was approachable, and therefore it helped inform my entire life. Like,
yeah,
this film is like the equal of Monty Python and the Holy Grail in terms of like,
ooh, yeah,
if you get this at the pivotal moment in your life, you're set, but you will eventually move on to better stuff because you'll realize not actually the best work. Kind of aged. Oh no.
Oh yeah, it did, but I think also at the same time that aging almost works for the film to a degree, because it's kind of fascinating how looking at it nowadays, you have this 88 film that's set in the 60s, but also actually looks like it was made in the 60s.
Yeah, that entire film looks like it was made with like, not sets, but like you just found homes where like old people lived and nothing changed. And you were like, we're just going to rent this for an afternoon. We're going to shoot some stuff in it. We're not going to break anything. We're not going to touch anything. But we need all of your appliances, which have not been updated since like the 1950s and shit. And like, yeah, at the time, you could still find that. And especially in a typically lower income area like Baltimore, where people would have to hang on to stuff forever. And like, you live in a place for decades instead of getting moved out because of a new development. Yeah, this film feels very real. It certainly doesn't feel like a few million dollars. And in many aspects, and this is more an attribute to the skill of the 2007 version, it feels like an off IP performance. Like, there are versions out there of the Phantom of the Opera that don't include any of the music, and like change the plot and the appearance just enough that they can't get sued. This feels like the non-musical performance version to scam idiot tourists, just fucking outright dramedy, stage dramedy of Hairspray. And it's like, we can't sing any of the songs, and we had to change a couple of the characters and break them up into separate characters to avoid being sued. But damn it, here it is. It's the I don't know, the Pictou County Players present Hairspray, not affiliated with the musical.
Oh yeah, so it was like the Italian B movie knockoff cinema version.
Exactly. Yeah, every now and then you'll come across one in small towns. And I, for one, love small town, barely legal theater like that. It's like, do you really have the rights to perform Amadeus? No, but like, I'm pretty sure Falco's lawyers aren't coming around.
Yeah.
Okay, but I'm pretty sure that song's not actually in the movie. I'm pretty sure you can go fuck yourself.
Yeah, we don't have the rights, but we won't tell if you won't.
Yeah. I love that level of theater. And then that's what this feels like as well. Like,
yeah,
everyone in this is quite talented, and half of them are quite famous and very random. Why is Debbie Harry and Sonny Bono in this? Fantastic. And of course, Ruth Brown, holy shit. Godmother of like R&B and actually just outright R&B. She was discovered, I believe, by Cab Calloway's sister. Like, she's practically royalty, and she's in this film, and it makes complete sense how they recast that later. And it's like, this film is such a love letter to a thing that pretty much actually happened, like with the exception of Tracy Turnblad. And the literal name of the Corky Collins show, this all happened kind of. And, you know, what John Waters did is he's inserted a white character into it. And that, it wasn't problematic at the time. It's kind of problematic now.
Yeah. It's here, especially, it is very white savior-ish.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because
like, the entire movement is around her desire to dance on TV. And it's like, yeah, that's a valid reason to give black people rights. Yeah. I mean, we could do it based on, you know, their own validity, but no. No, you go dancing, teenage girl.
But also, just a quick side note with Ruth Brown. I just wanted to comment about how I love that you question why Ruth Brown is in this movie and then instantly laid out exactly why Ruth Brown is in this movie.
Yeah, yeah. Like, yeah, that was beautiful. Exactly. It's and again, like the recasting they eventually do for the 2007 version serves pretty much the same purpose because,
yeah.
Oh God, the white saviorism.
I mean, with the 07 version and Queen Latifah, it's I think Ruth Brown gave the better performance, but I'm also looking at the 07 version and going, aside from Queen Latifah, really, who else would you get?
Yeah, it was a very limited field at the time. I mean, now you could have Lizzo.
Yeah.
But at the time, and this came out around the same era as Chicago, and it's like, no, you get Queen Latifah. You put Queen Latifah in your musical, et cetera, et cetera, money.
Yeah, and like I even between Queen Latifah and Lizzo, I would probably still go more toward Queen Latifah.
Oh yeah, without a single doubt.
If we were talking between Queen Latifah and Jennifer Hudson, that might be a little more debatable.
That's debatable, but Jennifer, like, one thing that this film and the resulting musical are very strong on is insistence of body image and positivity. And
yeah,
quite frankly, she's not large enough.
Fair.
Yeah. Yeah. And like that, that's purely that you have to, because it's part of the inherent message of this that gets much more apparent in the musical version. You have to be proud of the character being overweight. You have to be proud of the characters looking weird. Like, Jerry Stiller is in both of these for a damn good reason, and it's because he looks real. You know, he looks like John Waters,
yeah.
the way John Waters looks real. Like, You look kind of weird. You look like you weren't randomly generated by an AI or meant to be perfect for screen. And everyone in this is supposed to kind of look like that. With of course, there's one exception that gets to go get away with it, and it's because it's the best performance he gives in his entire career. We will get to that. We will get to that. But everyone else has to be there. Size, and maybe Jennifer Hudson could wear a fat suit and that would work, but I don't know if, like, I don't know that the politics of that would be ridiculous. Let's just go into that.
I think it's a case of you're thinking more visually where I'm thinking more vocally.
Yeah, and this is true. The vocals, like, obviously she would be amazing.
Queen Latifah, her vocals have just such a gospel-ish feel.
Yeah.
And with that in mind, between Lizzo and Jennifer Hudson, I tend to think more Jennifer Hudson.
No, that's fair. Although, now, of course, I'd love to have heard Ruth Brown tackle some of the characters' songs. But, of course, instead, what we get are, like, it feels like hints towards the songs, even though it's actually reverse engineered the other way. It's fascinating how well this could essentially be like the novelization of a musical.
Oh yeah, no, it absolutely, like, I, to be perfectly frank, there are several actors in the 88 version that I would be really interested in seeing what they could have done with the 07 script.
Yes. Oh God. Yes. Like, I want to see the original version of this that would have appeared on Broadway in the 80s. Like, if it was able to get the full clout it needed. And it would have been amazing to see Divine sing. Unfortunately, yeah, yeah. They died not long, like 3 weeks after this was released. It's like, ooh, for fuck's sake.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
yeah, I was just like, Divine was like literally at the top of the list of people I had in mind.
Yeah, and didn't even get to see it hit VHS.
Oh, yeah, that's not okay.
Yeah, this is the last like classic John Waters film. It's where the party stops, unfortunately. He still made stuff afterwards, but you know.
Yeah.
Now, of course, in 2002, the film eventually reappeared after kind of becoming a cult classic and stagnating in terms of, like, hotness. You know, only nerds talked about this. Only queer nerds, for the most part, talked about this. You know, John Waters weirdos. And it became a Broadway musical sensation that won 8 Tony Awards. Music by Mark Shaiman, lyrics by Scott Whitman and Mark Shaiman, book by Mark O'Donnell and Thomas Meehan. Holy shit. John Waters must have lost his goddamn mind when he got approached for this, because it's like, we're going to take
the
fluffiest film and we're going to turn it into an over-the-top, goddamn-dickulous musical. And it, quite frankly, it's one of my absolute favorites. Like, I could listen to the soundtrack perpetually. I don't even have to listen to the soundtrack. I can just think about it for a moment, and I can hear the entire track in my head. I know the lyrics of, like, 98% of this show. It's obscene.
Well, I mean, I don't know, like, really everybody's got their thing. Some of us may be more willing to admit it than others, but make no mistake, everybody's got their thing.
Yeah, no, this is true. And musicals are definitely my thing. As well, sharing the 98th percentile is, like, Chicago and practically everything Andrew Lloyd Webber ever did, and, like, an unfair amount of the producers. I wouldn't say unfair. That, in fact, that should probably be the most important thing. But that actually brings me around. So, as you said before, John Waters' involvement in this was more or less like, he gave a couple of ideas, but it was like, okay, have fun. That, you want to make a music? Okay, have fun. Which is entirely to be in contrast with how Mel Brooks did the producers, which came up after this, if I recall. This won 8 Tonys, and everyone was like, oh my God, it's the musical of the century. Nothing will ever top this. And then Mel Brooks in his like 80s was like, oh, well, fucking show you. And he took the other tactic and he wrote the entire goddamn thing himself. And it became the most winningest Tony Award winning show ever. And so, and then that was followed by Book of Mormon, which again, vomiting awards and so forth. Tony really, like, the Tony Awards really fucking kicked off, I feel, in terms of relevance again with Hairspray coming back. And it was, of course, inevitable at that point that a movie be made. And quite frankly, this is one of my, like, it's one of my favorite musicals. This is one of my favorite musical movies. This is one that gets it so precise. Like, I talk about the producers before because it's like, sometimes the translation back onto screen doesn't fucking work. It just, it collapses. Yeah. This is a film of a musical of a film. And sometimes you lose something. And with the producers, everything is flat. But this film is alive and active. And it is thought deeply about the space and how it can better use the space. Like, it comes from the musical background, the stage background in its approach. But it, and like, it doesn't restrain itself to the original film in any kind of way. But it absolutely just dives right in into the potential of movie magic, the craft there. And quite frankly, director Adam Shankman, he's a judge from So You Think You Can Dance. He directed, quite frankly, one of the most competent films out there. It's just, wow, that was fucking competent. That is a solid floor you built.
Yeah, that, and also for me, like, for someone who is really not a musical person, like, I've so many musicals and musical films I've encountered, when the songs hit, they tend to just feel so random.
Mm-hmm.
That before this, the only musical product that I've ever truly enjoyed was Once More with Feeling from Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Well, actually, that and Repo the Genetic Opera, but mostly Once More with Feeling.
Yeah, I mean, everyone likes Repo the Genetic Opera.
As they should. but like, the thing for me there was the songs felt more like they either helped explain the plot or helped move the plot forward. And it was the same thing for me with the 07 Hairspray. Like, with the 88 one, I kept getting lost because you have these two A-level stories that seemed like they were competing with each other. And my interest kept fading in and out because so often I had no idea what was going on. But this all connects beautifully because I believe, choreographer on Once More with Feeling was one Adam Shankman.
Aha! Ah, the brilliant bastard. He knew exactly what he was doing.
Oh, yeah, you know, like, I saw that bit on the IMDb trivia, I'm like, there is so much of my experience with this movie that makes so much more sense now.
Suddenly it's all like, oh.
Yeah.
Oh. Starring Nikki Blonsky, John Travolta, Michelle Pfeiffer, Christopher Walken, Amanda Bynes, James Marsden, Brittany Snow, Queen Latifah, Zac Efron, Elijah Kelly, Allison Janney, and just like a wonderful cast of randomly selected extras that look super memorable, but you'll never know their names. This is a delightful film to look at. It is bright, it is colorful, it is dynamic, it is in your face, and it is so cheesy and like self-aware of that cheese and reveling in it that it actually is allowed to get away with like the problems inherent in the original characterization, I feel. Like, more so, anyway.
Yeah, yeah, like, the 07 one, to me, it's not just cheesy. This is, like, a tray of, like, high-end cheeses.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas the 88 one is, like, that nice block of, like, black diamond cheese or something that you get at the grocery store. It's still tasty. There are still things you're going to enjoy, but it's just not as good.
Yeah, I'll take it a step further. The 88 one is that decent cheese from the grocery store eaten at a lovely wilderness camp. You might have a really decent tent. It's a good camp. Decent camp. This one is an expensive array of cheeses on a silver platter held by a man who has had his name legally changed to Jeeves outside a glamping facility that was flown in by a gold-encrusted helicopter that is piloted by Elton John giving a blowjob to John Travolta.
Oh, like, literally as soon as you started, I was just sitting here like, okay, I know she's going to work glamping in somewhere, but I don't know how.
Like,
oh, this made me happy.
Oh, yeah. This movie goes so fucking hard. It goes so hard. And, like, no one goes harder in it. Everyone's top of their game. Everyone is fantastically top of the game. James Marsden gets through the movie without dying, so that's always a plus.
Yeah.
But John Travolta is absolutely giving the best performance of his life, and I want to say having the most fun of his life. And it just makes it a little bit sad that it's like, oh, we got to see what John Travolta could be if he was out.
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely, and I definitely agree that he definitely seems happy as can be on that set. And I was absolutely thrilled that in this version, Edna has an actual storyline.
And isn't just kind of a cruel, selfish bitch. Like, she's timid but caring. And she has incredible bravery because she's on the front line of a civil rights march going up against cops who will beat the shit out of you. She's not timid or selfish. She's just kind of like beaten back a little bit. But under that is a tremendous character. Whereas the original one, it's divine. She has the sliminess and like the... She's almost Dickensian, where it's just like, no, your future will be working at laundry.
Yeah.
And she like buries her in fucking clothing while going, no, dancing for you. You know, it's very Dickensian, very like, whereas this felt like a character who actually cared about their child. And as much as I enjoyed Jerry Stiller as the father in the first one, Christopher Walken is fantastic in this.
Oh, yeah.
And the chemistry, the pure, like, romantic chemistry between him and John Travolta is incredible. It's not necessarily sexual. It literally feels like, no, you two have loved each other for like 30 fucking years.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, like, there's that point in a relationship where it's past sexual, and it's more that you're just happy that this person is there.
Yeah, and he radiates it. It's a fantastic portrayal of the father character, who gets like a great couple of songs. Mostly one song, you know, the romantic song, but like he gets to be involved in some other songs. But like, how fucking wonderful is Christopher Walken in that song of just constantly accidentally insulting his wife? And like, you could play that so wrong in so many ways and have it not work. And he found it. Bing. And I don't think Jerry Stiller could have done it because it would have come off mean.
Oh, yeah, I think there is that, but there's also, I think Christopher Walken has more of a, like a stage Broadway-based background than Stiller does.
Yeah, I wouldn't say stage, because Stiller definitely did a lot of stage work in his career, but like it was all comedic, not...
Yeah.
Whereas, Walken had to be kind of more restrained and subtle, which is what a concept.
With Travolta, like Travolta and Walken, I was very much looking forward to that romantic number that you had mentioned, because it was like, I know that you're gonna have something like that, and I am dying to see how they play it.
Yeah, and that's kind of how you can tell it's a really good musical, because as you said, the the songs aren't random. They actually push the plot and push the character ahead. And so you can look at it and be like, ah, those characters will have a song. Because if they don't, that is inefficient. That is horrible fucking storytelling. And if you're looking at a show and going, those two characters have to have a song because that's just necessary, then it has to be there. You can't just be like, ha ha, subversion of expectation. Fuck you. No, this is not. Musicals are fucking. this is going to devolve into.
Smokey, this is not Nom. This is bowling. There are rules.
Hey, Walter, come on. It's just, hey, man, it's Smokey. So his toe slipped over a little, you know? It's just a game, man.
This is a league game. This determines who enters the next round robin. Am I wrong?
Musicals have a very, very set structure. And even if you are going to undermine that structure, there's a structure to undermining. And you follow it. And that's not me being like, no, this is stage conservatism. This is just like how musicals work. If you don't do this, it will fucking collapse. If you don't make it gay, it will not play.
No, and like, to be perfectly frank, like I messaged you while I was watching the movie, like this story works so much better as a musical.
Yes, like having certain aspects just expressed that way is so much more like efficient but excessive. Instead of just like a character, well, more like an actor having to find a way to emotionally express something on screen during a scene when other things are occurring, they can literally just fucking sing it. They outright state it. And it helps with this. Because you can have so much more. Like, there is more in the musical than the original.
Oh, yeah, there's, like, that first song was what brought me into the movie and made it a lot easier to connect with it.
Right, and it's a fantastic, upbeat introduction to your character and your settings. Everything about it is in there that you need, like a little bit of this, a little bit of that. And it's also like wonderfully tongue in cheek in the proper way. Subtlety is so bizarre on Broadway because you have to be restrained, but at the same time, you have to make like the obvious joke, but at the same time, not that obvious joke, the second obvious joke, and then hold for applause. And it's like, it can be really fucking weird when applied to film. And it just worked so goddamn well here. I keep coming back to how well the director did on it. When really I should also be saying Michelle Pfeiffer takes the fucking villain to another level.
They
streamlined that character. They did away with the husband. They imply that she murdered him. Which is just, yep.
Which, yeah, that works.
They give her a terrific, like, the way that they change up certain titles, like, she's Miss Baltimore Crabs. Amazing. Instead of, like, oh, they're both trying to get this Miss Automotive thing. It's like, that's probably more accurate to what happened. But,
yeah.
Fuck that. Miss Baltimore Crabs. That's great.
Oh, yeah, and also she's, I think, a combination of Velma and the station manager from the 88 movie.
Yeah, who was played by Divine, also, yeah.
No, it was, well, it's not Divine that I'm thinking of then. It was the blonde woman that you constantly see talking to Corny.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I mean, yes and no, but... she specifically worked with Corny. She was just outright erased. Like, outright erased. Yeah.
Well, and like, frankly, she needed to go.
Yeah, and the same with, like, no offense to Sonny Bono, but the same with the husband character. Completely superfluous. As you said, like, the two plots kind of, you can see where they intertwine, and this version, the 2007 version, shows you how they should intertwine. But it's so just kind of like random and staggering in the 88 version. Like, oh, and they go to, it's like a fairgrounds or a water park or something that the evil. Pardon?
In the 88 one, I think it was an amusement park.
Yeah, it's an amusement park. And, like, that's semi-based off an actual place and actual event that happened. Like, that's how close to truth that was. But that's so inefficient to have all that happen off there, and then you have a second conclusion that occurs in the in the TV studio? No, fuck that. She works in this TV studio. Like, it's so wonderfully efficient, and it gives her such incredible evil power over everyone else. Not only can she legitimately lord over her daughter, who in both versions is terrifically just horrible. Like, oh, I hate that bitch. Michelle Pfeiffer is given this wonderfully rebuilt character, and just... Everyone's trying to steal a part of this fucking show. Everyone's trying to steal it. Like, and she gets away with, I want to say, one of the bigger slices. Everyone's goddamn scene-eating, stealing motherfucker in this, and I love them for it. I love them!
Michelle Pfeiffer feels like, I want to do the sultriness of Catwoman one more time, but I want to do it with no restraint whatsoever.
Right, like, it feels like she's actually trying to do, like, Eartha Kitt, but Eartha Kitt older, trying to recreate, like, the femme fatale-ness. And it's like, you know that you're a little older, but you're not also accepting it, but it's just like, no, this is how I fucking roll. You know, sly, demure, cat-like, evil. But also sexy and unattainable.
Yeah, like, I was as soon as you mentioned Eartha Kitt, I started picturing Michelle Pfeiffer's Velma singing Santa Baby. I was like, yeah, that really does work.
Yeah,
that really works.
Michelle Pfeiffer and Eartha Kitt definitely approach characters the same way.
Yeah.
Which is my way of saying I really wish Eartha Kitt played Janet Van Dyne. As well, amazing in this, because Jesus Christ, is Amanda Bynes and James Marsden, and of course, as we said before, Queen Latifah. And this is the movie that made me fall in love with Zac Efron, because I love that they actually gave the character more. Like, they made him...
Yeah.
Dreamy and, like, unbelievably desirable and seemingly like, oh, you just know this guy's gonna be a complete prick. And it turns out, no, he is fucking head over heels with the protagonist. Like, it's a power fantasy somewhat of, like, yeah. And then the hottest, cutest, most popular, nicest guy in school will totally fall for me. And yep.
Yeah, and, well, I mean, first of all, how has Zac Efron never played Elvis?
Right? I think it's one of those things where it's like, is that too obvious? Maybe it's just too on the nose. Or like, maybe he has a thing where he's like, man, I had to do that growing up to entertain my family so much. I'm not doing it. It's in my contract. Will not play Elvis.
Well, yeah, like, that could very well, because a lot of his mannerisms here, I could totally see Elvis.
Oh, yeah. He's got the hair, he's got the face, he's got better eyes than Elvis. I'm sorry. He's just fantastic at being that exact era, and that, he exudes a certain air that you expect to be negative, and it comes off so wonderfully unexpected when he just, like, completely drops the white bitch and, you know, the blonde white bitch, and he goes, no, fuck it, I'm for civil rights and this lady now.
Yeah, and just the simple fact that he actually has a story. His yes. character actually has some conflict. Right. Instead of being part of the everything that is handed to the Mary Sue that is Ricky Lake's Tracy Turnblad.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you definitely get more of a sense that that Tracy Turnblad for no reason became a massive celebrity, whereas the inherent ridiculousness of musicals makes that transition into like a minor celebrity make sense, because it's like, okay, yeah. no, that's over the top. She's not actually a celebrity. That's just, you know, musical logic. Whereas in the original film, it's like, really? You're famous? Really? Are ya? You know, I know fame was different back then and could be regionalized and stuff like that, but it's just like, it felt so forced. It was just, it wasn't necessarily a problem at the time, but when you see how it can be made more efficient and focused, so good. And as you were saying, Ricky Lake's Tracy Turnblad is, she's given everything, essentially. And like, Ricky Lake does a great performance, but she doesn't necessarily have to strain too much. Nikki Blonsky, holy fucking shit. Nikki Blonsky. Like, she's given nothing because she's given everything. She has given it all to you. She doesn't need anything. Everything is for you, the audience. And from fucking frame one, she is going hard.
Yeah, and like, I believe this was actually her first role.
Yep. Yeah, she's like, she was discovered for this and unfortunately doesn't get as much work as she should, because kick the crap out of this out of nowhere.
I think part of that is a bit of trouble with the law.
Oops. Let's find out what Nikki did. What'd you do, Nikki? Violent confrontation.
I'm just scrolling through the IMDb trivia right now, because I don't remember quite where I saw it, but I thought I saw something about her and her parents being arrested for some sort of race-related crime.
Yeah, so here's what Wikipedia briefly says. So in July 2008, Blonsky and her parents were involved in a violent confrontation with the family of Bianca Golden, a former contestant on America's Next Top Model, at the Providenciales International Airport in Turks and Caicos. Golden, Blonsky, and Blonsky's father were all charged with assault. That December, charges against Blonsky and Golden were dropped. So they proceeded with her father.
Okay, yeah, that was probably, because I know what I saw didn't even have that.
Well, that would be terrible. It would explain why no one, like, works with her anymore, really.
Yeah, I think she's predominantly, like, let me just quickly double check, but I think she's predominantly just done, like, voice work.
Yeah, let's see. The last movie she was in doesn't even have an entry. The one before that was The Last Movie Star, starring Burt Reynolds. That's good and random.
TV series.
Not much after that. Yeah. Yeah, it dried up for her, and I guess now we maybe know why. Well, that's terribly frustrating. I hope that it's not the worst, but it probably seems to be, since not many people are working with her. It's a shame, because she gives a fantastic performance, and despite her potential crappery, this still remains one of my favorite musicals. It may have to slide down a bit if the star is a racist dirtbag, but then again, Richard O'Brien hates trans people, so fuck! Musicals! They're complicated!
Yeah, but I think it's almost like, I think for a lot of the Harry Potter fans, where it's like, I this content means everything to me, but I don't like you.
Gee, isn't it nice that John Waters hasn't had something like terrible revealed about him. Yay.
Yeah, the thing that worries me there is, as with many celebrities, give it time.
No, no, John Waters is perfect. No, no, don't take this from me. Don't take this from me.
You're probably going to hate me for saying this, but I did have one complaint with John Travolta.
No, no, no complaints with John Travolta. No, if you that, complain about that, it, he'll go back into his closet.
That fat suit.
Oh, yeah, it's bad.
Oof.
It's
Oof.
Bad. Now, here's the thing. The character is portrayed fat, so it's always been, like, a part of the character.
Oh, yeah.
And Harvey Fierstein, at the time, was portraying the character on Broadway and brought the character to Broadway. Like, you have to think of every single line that John Travolta whispers in this as being, oh my God, which definitely changes some aspects of it.
Oh yeah. No, like I have no problem with the fact that he was in a fat suit. It was more that there were points where I could see the seams of the fat suit.
I kind of like that. Like, I like that there are aspects of this that look stagey.
Yeah, I mean, I agree, but I think in my case it was more when I read about the fat suit being described as realistic. when I saw moments where he would move, and the fat suit would move in ways that human skin does not move.
It was realistic for 2007 musical comedies. In which John Travolta appears as a fat woman. you have to really look at the fine print on that.
Yeah, no, I was just gonna say, like, you had to get damn specific, because I was sitting here all ready to go, Eddie Murphy would like to have words with you.
Oh my god!
But yeah, no, like, other than that, It's fascinating how, but between the two versions, like, everybody's doing a great job with what they're given, but in the 07 cast is so beautifully able to step it up. Like, what was his name? Sean Thompson, who played Corny Collins in the 88 version, plays a great show host. James Marsden, If the Dick Clark biography ever comes to Broadway, you call James Marsden.
Yeah, yeah.
And you give that man the lead.
There's a really funny thing, because so Corny Collins is based off a guy called Buddy Dean. Buddy Dean was the direct competition to American Bandstand. And, like, he would take guests that had been on Dick Clark, but Dick Clark had a very specific rule that if you show the fuck up on Buddy yeah. Dean, you will never be on American Bandstand. And Buddy
of course,
Dean,
back then, if you were never on American Bandstand, you went nowhere.
Yeah, and Buddy Dean, like, this whole segregated dancers issue on TV, on Baltimore TV, came up because Dick Clark moved the show to California, where they were integrated. And that led to a gulf in viewership. And so the Buddy Dean show became like the white supremacist version. Until there was a mass, like, oh, yeah. So much of this very ridiculous show happened, like, not to the extent of Chicago, where it's like, all of this is true, we didn't even change some of the fucking names, you know, like, this is barely fiction in many ways.
Oh man,
yeah, I love this. Yeah. Goddamn film and I want to say novelization on screen. Yeah. 1988 is a novelization on screen of the beautiful musical that is 2007's Hairspray.
The only other thing I would want to note is that as much as we're supposed to be rooting for Tracy over the course of the movie, the fact that she does not win in the 07 version, and instead it's little Inez, the little black girl, who wins, I was like, oh, thank God.
Yeah, it makes much more sense, and it's a great character development.
So, yeah.
It's just one of those tiny little things that, like, oh good, it's not all about her. It is actually about, you know, the black community. Maybe they're doing it for their own rights and not your dancing. I really think that the performance in the film between Amanda Bynes' character and Seaweed is far more compelling. And maybe that's just because they kind of let Amanda Bynes go off and she never really came back. She kind of very much decided, no, fuck this. I'm going to just do the opposite of what everyone wants in my entire career. And it kind of starts here, and it's great here.
Yeah. And it only took her about 15 years, but I think she's like finally starting to come back around.
I'll be very interested to see where that goes. Which one are we doing next anyway? Like, which dare we do next?
You know what? I was originally thinking we'd put Carmilla more toward the end of the month.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also getting just such an itch to just go back and rewatch the web series that I'm kind of thinking, let's do Carmilla next. Then Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
And then we'll end with
The Secret.
I'm just thinking Carmilla and Priscilla, putting them in the middle, they're kind of interchangeable. But that one at the end needs to be at the end.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Well, if you enjoyed this episode and if you're looking forward to that, please like, share, subscribe, and leave a comment. Send us anything you want. Send us some hate mail. Send us some emails. Send us a lovely box of cookies that you have not poisoned. I'm hungry. Where can they send that to?
Well, I don't know about the box of cookies since we don't exactly have a P.O. box.
You don't need a P.O. box. Just email it to me. Just email it to me.
That's not really how email works.
Excuses.
Everything else, you can email us at realgeekshfx@gmail.com. I mean, hell, if you want to throw in musicals that you want me to try, I'm game.
So my initial reaction is violence and to say cats, but I will restrain. I will hold myself back from doing that.
I only have one rule with cats.
Yeah.
It cannot be the version after they fix the special effects. I don't want to see the corrected version.
Then have I got great news for you. Because they filmed the original stage version in the early 90s. And it's fucking magical.
Oh, no, that I would do, but with the cinematic one, the things that I witnessed, that's how I want to remember this movie for all time.
Ah, yes. Ah, yes. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back later this week with the B-roll. At some point. Maybe. Probably.
We'll see. You'll hear from us in a couple days.
And if not, check out Real Geeks Classic, because drive them numbers. Drive them numbers.
And that's dropping the same time as this episode, so don't say we don't give you all the content.
It's more than you want. It's all you deserve. Till next time. Bye-bye.
See ya.
Then you'll do it. Do it. Of course not. It's not my kind of thing. I mean, Max, please. World War II? Ooh, too dark. Too depressing. The theater's so obsessed with drama, so depressed, it's hard to sell a ticket on Broadway. Shows should be more pretty. Shows should be more witty. Shows should be more... what's the word?
Gay?
Exactly. No matter what you do on the stage, keep it light, keep it bright, keep it gay. Whether it's murder, mayhem, or rage, don't complain, it's a pain, keep it gay.
People want laughter when they see a show. The last thing they're after is a litany of woe.
A happy ending will pep up your pay.
Oedipus won't bomb
if he winds up with mom.
Keep it gay,
keep it gay, keep it gay.
Couldn't agree more, and you have our blessings, Roger, to make springtime for Hitler just as gay as anyone could possibly want. So come on, do it for us, please.
I'm sorry, Max, it's simply not my cup of tea.
Still, fair is fair. Perhaps I should ask my production team what they think.
Your production team, who are they?
You'll see, they all live here. Guys! Come say hello to me, Alistair and Bloom! This is my set designer, Brian.
Hello.
Keep it mad, keep it glad, keep it gay! Here's my costume designer, Kevin.
Hello. Keep it happy, keep it snappy, keep it gay. We're clever, creative, it's our job to see that everything's perfect for Mr. Dupree.
Scott, my choreographer.
Hi there!
And finally, last and least, my lighting designer, Shirley Markowitz.
Keep it gay, keep it gay. Keep it gay.
Now they all just read Springtime. What did you think of it, fellas?
It needs glamour.
And glitz.
It needs sequins.
And tits.
And so the rule is, when mounting a play,
keep it funny, keep it sunny, keep it gay.
What should we do?
Relax. Watch this. Roger, I think that Springtime for Hitler would be a marvelous opportunity for you. I mean, up to now, you've always been associated with, dare I say it, frivolous musicals.
You're right. I've often felt as though I've been throwing my life away on silly entertainments.
Mm-hmm. Dopey showgirls in gooey gowns. 2, 3, kick, turn, kick, turn.
Roger.
It's enough to make you heave. Nonetheless, I'm sorry, Max. I just couldn't do Springtime for Hitler.
Why not?
Think of the respect.
No.
Think of the prestige.
No.
Think of the Tony.
Tony, 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 Tony.
Ah.
What's the matter?
Oh, is he all right?
He's having a stroke.
What?
Of genius!
I see it at last. The chance to do something important.
Roger Dupree presents history.
Of course, that whole second act has to be rewritten. They're losing the war, excuse me. Let's do downbeat.
Roger Dupree presents history.
But maybe. Ooh, it's a wild idea, but it just might work. I see a line of beautiful...
beautiful girls dressed as stormtroopers, each one a gem. With leather boots and whips on their hips, it's risque, dare I say, S&M!
Love it!
I see German soldiers dancing through France, played by chorus boys in very tight pants. And wait, there's more! They win the war, and the dancers they do will be daring and new. Turn, turn, kick, turn, 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 kick, turn, a 1, 2, 3, kick, turn. Keep it sassy, keep it classy, keep it.
That is brilliant, brilliant, brilliant! I speak for Mr. Bloom and myself, Roger, when I say that you are the only man in the world who could do justice to springtime for Hitler. Will you do it, please?
Please!
Wait a minute. This is a very big decision. It might affect the course of my entire life. I shall have to think about it.
No!
I'll do it.
Oh.
I'll do it!
Sabu champagne!
Ah! Keep at the end, you wonderful cheer. Whether it's Hamlet, Othello, or Lear, keep it gay, keep it gay, keep it gay.
Comedy's joy is a constant delight. Dramas annoy us and ruin our night.
So keep your Strindbergs and Ibsens at bay.
I'll
sign
Roger Elizabeth Debris.
Keep it gay.